The title of my talk is Foot Soldiers in the African Green Revolution. And And this has to do with getting out on the ground in the trenches, not up at the policy level so much, but trying to figure out what's sort of mucking up the works, where is the sand in between the gears, really on the local level, why aren't things working out? Why are there so much variability in yield? Why does it work? Why are things working in some villages and not in others, for some farmers and not in others? And sometimes it takes a closer look to see that. So the mission is to identify and help solve problems related to soils on the ground as a kind of a ground level soil science. This is actually seeing these ecosystems in the village and the community through a soil science lens, but trying not to be too myopic about it. The nice thing about working in Millennium Villages, which is where the experience I'm going to talk about today, is working in seven of the Millennium Village clusters, kind of as a troubleshooter, is that according to the philosophy of the whole program, and I think what really makes the Millennium Villages work, is that it integrates all these sectors. So while I was working in agriculture, it was necessary to interface with health, education, water, environment, businesses, and other sectors. And of course, working in village agriculture was a great opportunity to see a wide range of, do I dare use the word textbook examples? You can imagine some of these will end up in a textbook sooner or later. From extremely acid soils and aluminum toxicity that didn't let anything else work, to extremely alkaline soils and ammonia volatilization and sodicity that also might not have allowed fertilizers and other systems to work. Physical problems, water problems, you name it. But I like to think that there was basically three kinds of problems that on the ground we need to be aware of and try to solve. There are those that the farmers believe they have, and they're seeking help. And there are those that project personnel, extension agents, believe farmers have and are seeking help with and trying to educate farmers about. But perhaps most importantly, there are those that neither groups realize that they have. And that's where it's really important, I think, to get a fresh pair of eyes to come in from the outside and see this, and sometimes you can, this fresh pair will see the forest, the trees for the forest. So I've tried to put together some guidelines, four sort of sets of guidelines for working on the ground in the villages and trying to make a difference. The first is you really need to be observant and really, really inquisitive. Use all your senses, touch, smell, look hard, and especially listen. Really talk with the project personnel that have been working in there and know the background, but also be sure to talk to the village leaders and, of course, the farmers. And don't forget the children. I find that the children are often much more open and very knowledgeable about what goes on. They're often actually doing a lot of the work in the field, and they can often relate very interesting details that help put the puzzle together. And, of course, you have to also talk to the soils and the plants. You have to listen to the soil and the plants. And by listening to plants, of course, I mean being able to read their signs of distress. It's really important to understand the hunger signs of plants, especially when they're presented as a mixture of different hunger signs. You don't get one at a time and other stresses together. An amber pair of glasses, sunglasses sometimes helps make these stand out, but this is definitely something that you want to do and learn to do on the ground that most of the people in the village don't have the experience with. And of course, you need to listen to the soil. This often means going a little bit deeper than farmers usually do. Farmers are most familiar with the surface soil. It's what they till, it's what they have in their hands, it's what they see. And often the problems really lie a little bit below that, and so you need to dig deeply as well. Often when I get off the plane and arrive in the country, before I head out to the village, first thing I may do, since TSA won't let you carry it on board, is to buy a shovel of some kind. Either that or borrow a hoe from a village farmer. It helps to have some tools with you that help you listen to the soil and ask it questions. And so I want to just briefly talk about these. And the good news coming out of the Green Revolution, and Africa is actually leading this, the most sophisticated soils laboratory that I have seen yet is the one in ICRAF in Nairobi. And it's being operated and run by Africans, and it's got state-of-the-art stuff I wish I had at the University of Maryland, stuff they wish they had at Beltsville, Maryland. Our best labs don't have it all in one place. They have it all in one place. And there's certainly a place for that, and this is part of the AFSIS program and the digital mapping and all of that. But there's also a place for doing things on the spot. simple tests, things that you can do in the field, get immediate feedback that farmers can see, and that you can start working out solutions on the spot. Because I know that the results from those lab tests may be months, years away. Sometimes the samples never get to where they're supposed to go. So some of the tools that I like to carry in my doctor's bag include this kit, which actually we created and published in 2003. It's a simple carbon, especially for labile cork carbon, that we can make a field kit, carry around. You can do this in the field. There's another great little kit that you use, a little tackle box and these mini sieves. It's published by Herrick in 2005. If you want to Google that, in a handbook on dryland ecology. And it very nicely shows, for instance, the physical changes that take place during a fallow year. This is in western Tanzania, in Bola Village, a 15-year fallow where the aggregates are stable. And afterwards, after 5 years of cultivation, where that stability breaks down. And so it's quite sensitive in looking at some of the physical and organic matter related degradations. And then there's been a lot of progress made in the last 10 years in terms of portable lab equipment, like the little pH meter and EC meters, which are really quite inexpensive and quite accurate. And I think it's important now not to come in and make these sort of mystery black boxes where you get magic numbers from, but to explain how they work to the local extension people. These are some of the extension coordinators in the Millennium Village in Mbola, and also to the farmers. These are so simple. Farmers are perfectly capable of doing it, and boy, when they do it themselves and see the results, it sticks with them a lot longer. I actually tried to leave some of this equipment behind. And it is pretty impressive accuracy. The little pH meter, for instance, pretty much was just as good as a laboratory analysis. This is using bottle drinking water, which certainly doesn't have, has a little bit of minerals in it, and the pH may vary depending on where you get it. And stirring with a stick in the field and just doing it for about 5 minutes. But as you can see, you get about the same results, pretty darn good, as compared to the samples that we sent off. These are from western Kenya, where I sent them off to a certified commercial lab. Now, there are lots of soil test kits on the market, and I'm always getting questions about some NGO that wants to buy a bunch of these and put one in the hands of every extension agent or farm leader or something. And generally, I find that they're just not productive. This is one that I took this picture in the Millennium Village office in Mbola cluster, and it had been sitting there for about 2 years. One of them had been used, done a couple of tests, and the other one hadn't been opened. And it's because they're just not very useful. First of all, most of them are too complicated. Some of them are real simple. You just drop in a tablet. But the real problem comes in terms of precision. We don't need to distinguish high, medium, and low. I can tell you right now, they're virtually all low. We need to distinguish between low, very low, and really, really low. if we're just low, we're probably all right. We can move on to something else. And if you look at these color charts, say in the pH, if you have a problem where the soil is getting near aluminum toxicity, you need to be able to distinguish the soils that are pH 5.2, 5.3, 5.4, and they're okay, and those that have kind of crossed the boundary and they're at 4.8 and 4.9, and you have problems and you're not getting nodulation or something, you can't do that with these kits. You can with the meter. Same with phosphorus. We don't test unless you spit into the sample by mistake. You won't get high and medium tests. So you really need to sort of look at in those lower levels where it just doesn't do the job. But there's some neat new things coming on the market. This is one that I just saw a couple of weeks ago. It's not designed for soils. It's designed for water industry and swimming pools and that kind of thing. So it's cheap. If you look at a scientific catalog, it'd be about $500. But if you can get this, if you Google around, I bought a few of them for $42 a piece for the set. The expensive part is actually the little sachets of chemicals, which you could make yourself, but they're already prepackaged, pretty nice. Given that our phosphorus is so low, if you want to stretch it a little bit, you can use the sachet and do several samples in one. But this is really pretty accurate. So $42 for the instrument and about 20 cents for analysis for the chemicals, so you can get some nice results. I found it to be quite repeatable. You just have to develop a system where you get the ionic strength of the malic down by dilution. It works pretty well. Second kind of batch of philosophical guidelines, I guess I can call them, would be to take an ecological view. Don't be too myopic. See the problem in context. All these problems, whether it's a fertility problem or an insect problem or disease or whatever it is, you need to look at it in context of the household. What can people really do about it? And how is it related to the people that are living there, the family, and the whole village? where is it in the village, in the watershed, and of course the region and the climate, and the climates and the soils of the region. You need to look across disciplines. It's very tempting if you have a hammer to see that everything is a nail, right? So, you know, I'm a soil fertility guy, so I'm always looking for deficiencies, but you have to also be looking for all the other sorts of problems. And remember, when you get out there, wherever you're from, you're not in Kansas anymore. Things are different. So often you see people trying to do it the way they grew up learning to do it. We need to take ecological viewpoint and understand the sort of ecosystem. An example of this is nutrient flows within the village. It's been studied quite a bit, and we know that typically in village agriculture, Africa and elsewhere, nutrients make a one-way trip to the homestead. One vehicle of this is fuel wood, all of the wood that you see the women carrying from farther and farther away. And this actually brings nutrients from those outlying fields where most of the food is grown to the homestead. And in most cases, it's not used. It's swept away and swept into the home gardens right near the homestead. And so these are usually quite fertile. And this is reflected in the pH. The pH is a good indicator of this kind of fertility gradient. And so when you're right near the home in the kitchen garden, you might get a pH of 7.5. This is Western Tanzania again. When you take the same family's fields where they're growing most of their crops, the pH is much lower because the nutrients have been much more depleted. And this is a fairly consistent thing that you can look at throughout the village. This is some data from Mbola, which I collected during the course of about a week. So the fields away and near the home. A third principle is focus on the people. I'm there to look at the dirt. That's what they sent me there for. But it's really the people that count. And you're not going to be able to do your job without getting some kind of developing some kind of rapport with the people. And so it really takes time. You can't kind of buzz in, look around for an afternoon, and buzz out, because you're just not going to make that connection. It takes at least a few days, or a week or so. I tried to spend a few weeks in each village. You need to talk to farmers. You need to talk to lots of farmers. The story you get is always different, because they don't really know what you're trying to ask. And you don't always know what you're trying to ask either. And do the talking out in the fields. When you're out in the fields, the soils, the crops, the environment will be evocative of all kinds of issues that they'll bring up that they won't bring up if you talk to them in an office. I also try to use my camera, obviously take pictures, but I try to use the camera as something to connect with the community rather than make me into a kind of a tourist and taking pictures. And one way I do that is I send back laminated family portraits, and that's been very popular and really noticed, especially if you make a second trip to the village. The translators are also important. And I know a little bit of Chichewa, and I know a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But frankly, you know, in Africa, village farmers speak so many different languages. If you're moving, unless you're from the area, you're probably not going to speak their language. You know, even the Kenyans need translators when they're in another part of Kenya. So translators can also be the teachers. But make sure that you get translators that are extension agents, or translators that are in the project and know something about it. And the kids are really great at this. Most of them are going to know some English or some French. And research. Research opens doors. It's not only something you want to do to learn about a problem, but having a research project which requires you to have a certain sampling scheme and visit certain sites is an entree, an excuse for knocking on a lot of doors that would be very difficult to do. Why are we looking at yet another farm? Well, we need it for the research program. And so this has really helped make those connections. An example in Gumalira, one of the new millennium villages, of quickly finding that the teenage kids speak much better English than they let on. He's a little embarrassed, but the village is guessing the pH of the ashes. Even the extension agent thought, oh, it's going to be as high as 7. So it was kind of an exciting shock to him when it came out around 11.5. Okay? And sometimes you have opportunities for education right there in the village. We've got quite a crowd gathered around. And if you can pay attention to the kind of cadences and the way people talk in different parts of the, you know, what the local culture is, you can even do this through translation. This is talking about water conservation in Gumalira. It's a pretty big crowd. Just some examples of how sampling seeds and soils allowed me to make connections that I couldn't have done otherwise. And of course, it also provides some very interesting data. In this case, having to do with biofortification foods, I'm really concerned about the legumes and the way legumes respond differently from grains and how that might affect the quality of those legumes. An example from Uganda, high rainfall, banana growing area. This pea field should be a lucrative cash crop. They eat some, but they mostly grow it for sale. And all the fields we were looking at were doing very, very poorly. These were going to be crop failures, and they had asked me to come out to this part of the cluster to take a look at these. And after looking at two or three of them, I started to notice a pattern. It was the centers of the fields that were doing so poorly. Actually, around the edges, you can see standing behind Robert, the ag facilitator, the plants are doing much better. We dug them up, looked at nodulation. After talking to, it must have been seven or eight farmers and the extension guys, we finally figured out it's nothing to do with what they were doing to the pea crop. It was, they don't even weed the pea crop. They don't consider that for something they don't weed it. But the previous crops, the habit there, the custom there was to pull all the weeds out and throw them at the side of the fields, the boundaries of the fields. So they had piled up, essentially were making compost around the side of the fields. And so, of course, they had enriched the field boundaries and impoverished the bulk of the field. And on the back of the pickup truck, we did a few quick tests of carbon, pH, and a few other things, took samples from around the boundaries and the centers of a couple of fields, and looked at nodulation and whatnot. And in fact, this actually panned out. There was a difference in the microbial available carbon and also a striking difference with very little variability in the pH. I think this is just tipping over the edge into the aluminum toxicity area, and that may explain why we didn't get any nodulation in the peas in most of the field. So there are lots of opportunities then to do more than just the soil science. I always try to enlist the farmers. This is a really brilliant guy, self-made, self-taught man in Senegal. His name was Diop, like many other people in the area. And the other two gentlemen are the ag extension workers for the project. And we were in an area that they were having salinity problems. And I used what I had on me, which was I always carry some toilet paper for obvious reasons. So I was using the toilet tissue to explain capillarity. And we had a whole lesson there in the shade, because it was really, really hot, of how the water rises as the water table gets near the surface. You get this capillary rise, and it brings the salt with it. And this is really why the fundamentals behind the salt problems that they had in certain parts of their fields. And this was a principle that they didn't know, but they were really soaking it in. So that now, when I leave, they can kind of look at a landscape and see that. An application, this was just when we visited in Senegal, where they have these salinity problems, and the pH of the soil is quite high. It's an arid region, so the pHs are usually up in 7. Sometimes they're sodic, so they're up with 8, 8.5. The water is sodic, and there are these kinds of problems. This is a little onion field, and each of these little onion fields near Poitou had its own dug well. These wells are maybe 8, 10, 15 meters deep. And you let a bucket down, you bring some water up, and each of these little onion basins are irrigated with that water. And this one's not doing too bad, but they wanted me to go over and see these fields, not more than 100 meters away, that they had to abandon. The crops were completely failing, and they looked like this. They were mostly in weeds. They had abandoned them for several years, and some areas like this were so bare and bad that even the weeds wouldn't grow, and what was wrong with the soil? But we sat down in the shade with the village elders and the farmers, and again, they're doing the analysis themselves, so they kind of get a kick out of this and explained what it was all about. And the soil really didn't hold the answer, but when I went to the well and asked them to bring up a bucket of water, this was the pH of the water that they were using to irrigate that field, 3.5. I said, oh, dang, I busted my pH meter. I must have knocked it around too much or let it dry out or something. It has to be something. I had a little bit of standard, you know, buffers with me, and I recalibrated the thing. Nope, 3.5. Well, there's only one problem that could create 3.5 in the water and dug well, and that's acid sulfate oxidation. And sure enough, some of those wells had cut down through layers with pyrite or minerals in them, and so they had to really watch what well they were using for the irrigation. The soil so far actually hadn't been destroyed too much, it was just the water. Fourth area is to do something about it. Look for solutions, don't just identify the problems. There are a lot of problems out there that people didn't know they had. Really encourage farmers themselves to try stuff. And while you're there as an advisor, as an expert, start something going. Try something. And heck with a report. Get something done on the ground. And look for what's already there. What's low cost, no cost? What do they have? Are there nutrients they're not using? Wasted water, lots of wasted water in the driest places, they're wasting water. And livestock management often comes into this. Just a little example from Uganda. I'm out here with this farmer, forget her name right now. She's in a field of groundnuts. The groundnuts are crying out for both potassium and sulfur, according to the deficiency symptoms. And of course, does she have potassium and sulfur fertilizer? Sure, of course she does. Her cooking ashes, especially the potassium, loaded in the ashes. If you ever thought of it as fertilizer, there are very few African villages that think of ashes as fertilizer. Some areas they do, but most they don't. And so we're actually spreading a few strips across her field. We marked them with stakes on the end. So she can see if these strips green up a little bit, and whether the crops are going to grow a little bit better. So everybody's got ashes. If you've got acid soils, the answer's in your kitchen or under your fire. Another thing that every African village has is human urine. Now, there are all kinds of social taboos, and it's a little bit worse in some of the Muslim countries than it is in some of the Christian countries. But this is actually a major nutrient source if you're farming one or two hectares of land. This was an example in where they just built a school, and they had just built, they're very proud of this, gender-sensitive latrines for the kids. So the little boys' latrine had a little trough where they could stand up and pee into it. So all that wonderful fertilizer going down. I figured out if you want to impress people, you have to tell them how much fertilizer it's worth. Well, it was worth about 8 kilograms of urea and 2 kilograms of DAP from one adult in a year. Reasonably fed adult. They always ask, does it matter how much beer I drink? I suppose it does. That really, like, it doesn't, may not seem like a lot to you, but every African farmer I've ever mentioned that to, their eyes light up. Whoa, I'm throwing that away. And you get volunteers. Another thing that most African countries have, in addition to rock phosphate, a lot of them have gypsum. Gypsum deposits are often very accessible, and gypsum is, you know, some rock phosphates aren't very available to plants, but gypsum is water soluble, or soluble enough to be available. Easily ground up, it's a soft mineral. I've seen women powder it just using their maize pestles. So sulfur is widely deficient. After nitrogen, it's right up there with phosphorus, as far as I can tell. And it's often available. It's sometimes even already mined and exploited for the cement industry. If there's a cement factory, they probably are putting gypsum in as a conditioner. You need to get a hold of some of that. So while you're out there, try this stuff. Put out some trials. It can be, you know, elaborate replicated field trials that you're going to try to collect data on, or it could be something as simple as down in the corner there where I had some collected from all the men volunteers. It's a little harder to get women to do this, but I've got an adapter. But all the men volunteers, and you need to remember to dilute this. If you're going to do this at home, be sure you dilute this two to one at least. So that's what's in the jerry can. I'm not trying to set the field afire. I'm making a big X of urine on a millet field that's obviously deficient in nitrogen and probably a few other nutrients on a hillside that everybody walks by. And the question is, will they see a big X out there? It reminds me a little bit of Ben Franklin, who rode across the field. This land has been plastered in early American history. So yes, I think there's a lot of things we can do with our soil science, with our agronomy knowledge when we get on the ground. To make a difference, we can empower the African farmers with some of this knowledge and pass some of it on. So let me make an appeal. I responded to Pedro's appeal that he made a few years ago, and it is the best year of my life I spent doing this. But the opportunity knocks, you know, say yes. Sign up to be a foot soldier in the African Green Revolution. Thank you.